I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. John Donne was a man of contradictions. He wrote sermons, and he wrote ardent devotional poems, but in his poems he also made some charming and convincing cases for seduction. And through leaps of logic, Donne sometimes combined faith and seduction in the same poem. He was an Anglican cleric against his will. He came from a Catholic family, but wrote two polemics against Catholicism. John Donne also brought into the language the famous phrases, "No man is an island, for whom the bell tolls," and "Go and catch a falling star." And we're going to explore the world and the writings of John Donne with Joshua Calhoun, professor of English at UW-Madison. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. It's so nice to be here.
I just find myself rolling up my sleeves and getting ready to dig into the poetry of one of my favorite writers, because it's so vivid and so intense, and at times funny, and at times just very direct, whether he's talking to me or to God or to his lover.
And sometimes it's hard to tell which.
Well, that's right. Again, he blends these things so skillfully that I guess he came under some criticism for, as they say, wreathing iron pokers into true love knots, as Coleridge put it.
Sure. And I think that that's the narrative he created in many ways for himself. He embraced the idea that there were two Dunns, Jack Donne, the young rake, the cavalier, womanizer, and Dr. Donne, the Dean of St. Paul's, who preached these beautiful sermons, lines we know like "No man is an island," or "Ask not for whom the bell tolls for thee," which of course Hemingway picks up as
sure.
The title. And so he goes both ways, and I think some of the fun sometimes is to look at the poem. The one way into them is to say, is this Jack Donne or is this Dr. Donne? But then as soon as you have sort of formed an opinion, you said this is Dr. Donne, you could really find moments of Jack Donne. These are not two fully separate characters. It's not exactly Jekyll and Hyde. And so you find eroticism in poems about God, and you find theology in poems about womanizing. And it keeps you on your toes as a reader.
Yes, it certainly does. A contemporary of Shakespeare and a late Elizabethan. And so what kind of world was he born into? Certainly one in which there was still a lot of antagonism between Catholics and Protestants.
That's right. They went through upheavals politically between Protestant and Catholic kings in Henry VIII that separated from the church. Donne was born into a climate that was probably more antagonistic towards Catholicism. Early in his life, there was a period when King James came to the throne in 1603 when it looked like it might be a bit more Elizabeth had perhaps sustained a way of having a Book of Common Prayer that was, you know, only sort of ostracizing the most extreme, the Puritans and the Jesuits on either side. But then the Gunpowder Plot of 1605, in which the accusation was that, and this is remember the 5th of November.
Yes, Guy Fawkes.
This is Guy Fawkes that supposedly they were trying to blow up Parliament.
Catholics.
Yeah, the Catholics were. And the idea being that would they would kill much of the ruling class, and then that would open up a vacuum of power for Spain to come in or something like that. And that, of course, then instigates a whole new wave of anti-Catholic sentiment. And John Donne, his family suffered this. His family had to move around a bit. He was quietly Catholic for part of his life. His brother Henry ends up dying in prison for being a Catholic. He's sent to prison, but he's sent to a dungeon where he's not exactly sentenced to death, but they knew by putting him in this these crammed quarters during a time of plague that he hardly had a chance.
And how did that affect John Donne?
We see a lot of conversation about death, about I think that Donne, even though he had in some ways a lot of privilege, like everyone else in this period, I think there's always the tragedy perhaps was a little bit closer. I always think this about this period, even when somebody was perhaps associated with the ruling class as Donne was and being preferred and being promoted in different ways and sometimes had positions given to him because of friends, tragedy was always very close to him. Having a brother die, having His wife eventually died after giving birth to a stillborn child, then died of complications from that pregnancy. And so death is always very close. And also, because the political climate can change so quickly, he has to always be finding the right side. I think one way it affects him is that we see, even after he converts to Anglicanism, he tends to try to stay in the middle. He does speak out against Catholicism, but really only the most extreme forms. And he tries to find a middle space. And this works with James because James fancied himself a peacemaker. So he was able to walk a line that I think may have been a line he really saw, the line of truth. And it may have been politically, it may have been a measured choice to stay right in the middle.
So at what point do we see Jack Dunn, this wild womanizer, come to the surface?
I think the famous one is The Flea. This poem is one that I think if people know a religious poem, often they know Death Be Not Proud, but often it's The Flea. And this is a poem that, of course, when I teach, it's a little bit hard to understand at first, but it's one of these rewarding poems because once you get it, you start to fully understand. And this is typical Dunn, where you're encapsulating an entire world into a tiny little bug.
And he's the logic here, he keeps flipping. It's really kind of mental arm wrestling with the woman that he's trying to seduce here.
That's right. It's if you'd like, we can read it.
Let's hear it.
Yeah, this is mark but this flea, and mark in this how little that which thou deniest me is. Me it sucked first, and now sucks thee. And in this flea our two bloods mingled be. Confess it. This cannot be said a sin or shame or loss of maidenhead, yet this enjoys before it woo and pampered swells with one blood made of two. And this, alas, is more than we would do. I'll stay three lives in one flea, spare where we almost, nay more than, married are. This flea is you and I, and this our marriage bed and marriage temple is, though parents grudge, and you were met and cloistered in these living walls of jet. Though use make thee apt to kill me, let not to this self-murder added be, and sacrilege. Three sins in killing three.
Then she squashes the flea.
She does, yeah. She purples her nail with this flea. And he changes the conceit. He sort of twists this again. You've killed the flea. And he says, all it took was a little drop from thee. What's the big deal in that? Cruel and sudden, hast thou since purpled thy nail in blood of innocence? And what could this flea guilty be except in that drop which it sucked from thee? Yet thou triumphest, insist that thou findest not thyself nor me the weaker now. 'Tis true. Then learn how false fears be. Just so much honor, when thou yieldst to me, will waste as this flea's death took life from thee.
So he's working both sides of the argument
here.
He is,
yeah. Yeah, suddenly, well, you know, it's not a big deal because we're already mingled in the flea, and it's not a big – didn't you kill the flea? Look, did you lose your honor by that? Well, then what would – you know, what would a little roll in the hay be to all our honor? You know, it's like a drop of blood from all our blood.
That's right. The mingling of our blood no more than in this flea.
Yeah, and it's a great example of – we see in this – we see the legal training. John Dunn had legal training. We often see this coming up, but we also we can see that he's thinking through, the language of the church, the confession, you know, and talking about the marriage bed and the marriage temple. So here we have a very bawdy poem, and interestingly, here too, you have the printing history of this. That third line, me it sucked first and now sucks thee, when it appears in the first edition, the 1633 first printing of John Dunn's poems, which I was looking at yesterday. We have it just right over in special collections here on campus.
Wow.
It's that first S in sucked both times, sucked and sucks, is a long S, which looks a lot like an F, which I'm not going to read it that way on air.
There was any intent going on there?
There's also a manuscript version that also uses this long S, and I think there was certainly some play going on. I think people saw the potential there, that in fact it might be something that rhymes with sucks.
Yes. Well, Don, we know, was a master of wordplay. Mm-hmm. In fact, Ed, we'll get a little later, I believe, into playing on his own name.
Yes.
D-O-N-N-E.
Yes, yes.
Well, he uses the same kind of logical twist, doesn't he, in a sonnet, a holy sonnet, called Death Be Not Proud that you mentioned.
That's right. If people know Donne, they tend to know this poem. One thing that has made it popular is a wonderful film that I recommend, in which Emma Thompson plays a professor who's dying of terminal cancer and is a Donne professor, and it's called Wit. And this poem is central to that that film, but it's perhaps maybe we could read it first, and then I think you'll hear too how different this is. A very measured poem. It's a proper sonnet form. We don't see Donne actually doing that many proper sonnet forms in the early poetry, in the Jack Donne poetry. He writes, "Death, be not proud, though some have called thee mighty and dreadful, for thou art not so. For those whom thou think'st thou dost overthrow, die not, poor death, nor yet canst thou kill me. From rest and sleep, which but thy pictures be, much pleasure then from thee, much more must flow. And soonest our best men with thee do go, rest of their bones and soul's delivery. Thou art slave to fate, chance, kings, and desperate men, and dost with poison, war, and sickness dwell. And poppy or charms can make us sleep as well, and better than thy stroke. Why swell'st thou then? One short sleep past, we wake eternally, and death shall be no more. Death, thou shalt die."
We're going to see that a little later, too, that same kind of logic in one of his poems in which he addresses God and wants God to swear by his own name. That something is true. But in Death Be Not Proud, this is a strongly Christian poem having to do with resurrection, wouldn't you say?
I think so. And I think that something that is – there's a few things that are atypical. I mentioned that the form, the meter, this measured sonnet. Some people see this as the culmination of Donne's theology. This is the later Donne. But I think there's a reasonable argument for this is a young man's thinking about death, a young man's confronting death. Death, thou shalt die. I think the later Donne has slightly matured attitude towards death, having perhaps seen more. And so there's always the question of when this was written. And that's always the case. Something that's interesting about Donne's poetry. And one reason I found myself just then, as I read Norman, I changed a couple words from the edition I'm reading because it's almost like a hymn. I know other words better. It wanted me to say, "and easier than thy stroke" at line 12. And I know it as "and better than thy stroke." And at the end, it wanted me to say.
Yes, which is what I see here.
Yeah, and when I said, "one short sleep past," this edition wants me to say, "we live eternally." And I know it as "we wake eternally."
Yeah.
And I like it better that way, but it's probably because that's the way I know it.
Well, that tells you of resurrection, of course, to
it
wake.
It does.
Yeah. And so in this poem, we don't know when he wrote it. Is that true of other poems by Donne? What was the publication history? Not until 1633, 2 years after his death?
That's right. So there are – Donne does not publish his poetry, with the exception of a couple commemoration poems. He writes this anniversary on the death of one of his patron. The Drurys had a daughter who died, and this beautiful poem, the anniversary, and some of those commemorations are published. Other than that, they are not published. It's an interesting history, though, because I it's a little bit of a white lie to say they're not published. The word published, what does that mean?
Right.
We think of that as printed. So more accurately, they're not printed until 1633. Now, they are published in many forms. And I think maybe one way to imagine this would be, I think actually, and this isn't my idea, a good friend mentioned this to me, Bob Dylan and John Donne have some commonalities in their lyrics, especially in something like "Go and Catch a Falling Star, Get a Child of Mandrake Root." There is some commonality, I think, there. And as you probably know, there's a history of getting bootleg tapes of Bob Dylan's, right? And so there is a market. There's a coterie, as they would say in this period. There's a small groups who appreciate this type of art, and if they have a new poem from Donne, they pass it around. They put it in what they call their commonplace books. They carry around and write new poems. And so we have, and this kind of blows my mind, we have over 5,000 examples of Donne's poetry in 240 separate manuscripts that we know about. And many of his poems survive in over 50 copies, handwritten. When I say manuscript, I mean handwritten, not printed.
Wow.
And so you can see that there was a market for these. It was a smaller group. It shows his affiliation with the ruling class and those who had the leisure to be passing these around. But certainly, he's publishing. He's getting his work out there, but they're not published. They're not printed until 1633, which is 2 years after his death.
So he had no control over any kind of little variants that might get out there, in other words.
He may or may not have. Interestingly, he made a move to publish his poetry in right around 1615, just before he was ordained. And he felt like maybe he needed to get Jack Donne out in the world before he was ordained and make a little money off it. There certainly would have been a market for it. The plan went awry, but not for lack of trying. He didn't end up publishing it at that time. So we have a sense that he was preparing some of his work for publication. And so that's always the question. The early editions of Donne tend to go with the 1633, that first printed edition. And again, it's wonderful to me, I still get chills being over in our archives and special collections and Memorial Library and being able to touch in the smell of that book and to be able to see some of the, we may talk later about some mistakes, especially when we talk about the hymn that you mentioned earlier. But as you look at that, you realize that somebody made some decisions, and suddenly if you have 50 versions of a poem you can compare it with, this, if you enjoy, and you can see here I have this edition, it's more notes than poetry.
Yeah, I see that.
If you want to be an editor of Donne, there's plenty of work for you.
Still plenty of room there.
Yeah.
Huh? Okay, I'll make a note. He was, I think above all, a very personal poet. Again, whether he's talking to God or whether he's talking to a lover or a potential lover. And a good example of that, he's talking not just to – actually, he's talking to the sun,
yeah,
which is a little different.
It's part of why I think that he's part of this group called the metaphysical poets who are thinking about the physical world and their place in it and trying to make these conceits trying to link themselves with the broader world and eternity and time. And here the sun rising, I think, is a terrific example of that. This is one that we would probably say is Jack Donne.
yes, I think
this
so.
this is Jack Donne in bed the morning after. And this is a type of poetry called an obad. I think it's actually wonderful. It's when I can see the lights come on with students here at the university. Say, have you ever, I don't want details, but have you ever, we have enough trouble getting out of bed anyway, but you're in bed with someone that you really appreciate and that you don't want to leave. Have you ever had that feeling? So don't tell me about it. And you can see the lights come on. And I think that's it's a strong emotion. I'm laying here in bed. I'm happy. Why should I move on? And he decides to take out his anger on the sun. He says, "Busy old fool, unruly sun, why dost thou thus through windows and through curtains call on us? Must to thy motions lover's season run? Saucy, pedantic wretch, go chide late schoolboys and sour prentices. Go tell court huntsmen that the king will ride. Call country ants to harvest offices. Love all alike, no season knows, nor clime, nor hours, days, months, which are the rags of time." Thy beams so reverend and strong, why shouldst thou think I could eclipse and cloud them with a wink, but that I would not lose her sight so long? If her eyes have not blinded thine, look, and tomorrow late tell me whether both India's of spice and mine be where thou left'st them, or lie here with me. Ask for those kings whom thou sawst yesterday, and thou shalt hear, all here in one bed lay. She's all states. And here I think it's worth noticing what he's doing with the S sound. He's going to slow us down. He's going to slow the sun down. She's all states and all princes I. Nothing else is. Princes do but play us compared to this. All honors mimic, all wealth alchemy. Thou, son, art half as happy as we in that the world's contracted thus. Thine age asks ease, and since thy duties be to warm the world, that's done in warming us. Shine here to us, and thou art everywhere. This bed thy center is, these walls thy sphere.
So he's saying that this room, with him and his beloved, the whole world.
It's the world, and the sun is revolving around it. And he could, I think this is one of the, just a wonderful line that is very much a Jack Dunn line. I could eclipse and cloud them. I could eclipse the sun by closing my eyes, but if I did, I would lose sight of her.
Yeah, you can't lay it on much thicker than that.
No, you really can't. And I also just love that how that last line does to the reader what he's wanting the sun to slow down, stop rising, right? And you cannot speed through those lines because of all the S sounds, the aspirates. This bed thy center is, these walls thy sphere. And if you try to go too fast, it just all runs together.
And I'm kind of reminded of a poem, I think it's by Andrew Marvel from a little later, the last line of something, if we can't slow the sun down, we'll make it run.
That's right. Having
so much fun, the time
That's right,
will
yes,
fly.
Yes.
Well, the time is flying, and we're going to be tapping more into the poetry, the remarkable poetry of John Donne, in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Joshua Calhoun, and we're looking at the remarkable poetry of a Shakespeare contemporary named John Donne, who had sort of two parts to his life. There's the wild womanizing Jack Donne, and then there is John Donne, the writer of sermons, and guess what? They're never really that separate, so far as we can tell. Is that true of this poem too, Josh?
I think so. As I said, it's sort of fun to approach these poems and say, okay, Jack or Doctor? And is this the young rake or is this the religious man? Something interesting happens toward the middle of his life. He is, as you say, a contemporary of Shakespeare's, born in 1572, 8 years after Shakespeare, and died in 1631, 15 years after Shakespeare. So he's just a little younger. He, in this poem, I think we see, perhaps, him talking about Anne Moore, the woman he married. As far as we can tell, now he managed his life story quite well. He fell deeply in love with Anne Moore, and he made a choice to marry her secretly. He was a secretary at the time. He had legal training. He was a secretary for a very powerful man, Sir Thomas Egerton. It was his niece. His niece was staying with in the family household, and Anne's father, George, he was trying to climb the ladder, and one way he was going to do this was by setting his daughter Anne up with somebody who would help him climb the ladder. And a secretary was not that person. And he was very upset. Dunn ended up in prison. He was in prison. He was eventually released, but Egerton never took him back to his job. So suddenly he was perhaps happily married but unemployed. And something interesting about Dunn is he's so smart, it's hard to imagine him not calculating all the options. He may have seen himself, oh, this maybe he would be preferred because he married George Moore's daughter. But he did a clandestine marriage. Some people will argue that, but he did a clandestine. It was a secret marriage. I think he knew the odds were he was going to end up in quite a bit of trouble.
So and he did it for love.
He did it for love, right? Mm-hmm. And so this is that narrative. Suddenly you have somebody who was running around womanizing, and he found his other half. He found his immortal beloved. And what I love about this poem, The Good Morrow, is on the one hand, if it's about Anne, it's this absolutely beautiful poem, especially the opening lines about the one beloved. On the other hand, the rakish Dunn, I can see using this as a pickup line in the local tavern. So I'll read it. It says, I wonder by my troth what thou and I did till we loved. Were we not weaned till then, but sucked on country pleasures childishly? Or snorted we in the seven sleepers' den? 'Twas so, but this all pleasures fancies be. If ever any beauty I did see, which I desired and got, 'twas but a dream of thee. And I think if you're looking for a great line to say to a woman, yeah. Right? Or, in this case, Dunn is speaking to a woman. If ever any beauty I did see, which I desired and got, 'twas but a dream of thee. I've been chasing women around and sleeping with a lot of them, but I was looking for you.
Yeah, right.
And yet, it appears that that may have been the case with Anne. He never remarried after she died. And as far as we can tell, they were very happily married, though not happily employed for a while because of the rift it caused.
Yeah, what they'll say, 12 children in 16 years.
That's right, yeah. And eventually Anne died as complications from childbirth at the age of 33. And, you know, but there's something beautiful here, too. You get a little bit of the Catholic background of Dunn with The Good Morrow. You have the Seven Sleepers' Den, which is a story of these children who survive religious persecution in Ephesus by going to sleep for, I think, 187 years or something like that. This is the Seven Sleepers' Den, and they're snorting in the Seven Sleepers' Den.
Yes.
And so he imagines, right, that he's been, life is a dream. He's been living this dream.
He's been asleep until he saw
until
her.
He's found her, yeah. Which is beautiful. And he's also grabbing the story, and, you know, there's certainly, at the same time, his brother, Henry, at this point, is dead. Because he was Catholic. And so you have, there's so much bound up in here. I think we see a lot, and it's hard to say, this is definitely Dr. Dunn. Certainly, it's informed by Jack Dunn's mischievousness and his Catholicism. Should we read the rest?
Yeah.
Okay. And now, good morrow to our waking souls, which watch not one another out of fear, for love all love of other sights controls and makes one little room and everywhere. Let sea discoverers to new worlds have gone. Let maps to other worlds on worlds have shown. Let us possess one world. Each hath one and is one. My face in thine eye, thine in mine appears, and true plain hearts do in the faces rest. Where can we find two better hemispheres without sharp north, without declining west? Whatever dies was not mixed equally. If our two loves be one, or thou and I love so alike that none do slacken, none can die.
There are a couple of Dunn themes in there, aren't there? Of course, the immortality, mm-hmm. none can die, which is pretty prevalent, I guess, in Elizabethan poetry. You see it in the Shakespearean sonnets, for example.
Right.
But also, in effect, in our room, or if you will, our love is the whole world, as we saw in Busy Old Fool and Ruly Sun.
Yeah, and I think this, his ability to go macro to micro, we saw it with The Flea too. And I think that some, even, you know, musicians, there is a line, an artist I saw here not too long ago, The Orpheum, Neutral Milk Hotel, that always reminds me of this. It says, what a beautiful face I have found in this place that is circling all around the sun. And the first time I thought, that's done, straight up done, right? It's the face. Mm-hmm. And just zooming so quickly from the face to the
orbit.
To its orbit around the sun. And he does that. Suddenly we're all in this little room. This theme of going in and out of seeing the big picture and every little detail of the small picture. Yeah.
The canonization is actually one of his – that's the longest one that we'll be looking at.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a direct address to a person not exactly specified, but for God's sake, hold your tongue and let me love.
Yeah, this is this one, it would be hard to imagine being written before Anne. he seems to be speaking directly those who have imprisoned him and then made his life hard because of his marriage. But he does. He writes, "For God's sake, hold your tongue and let me love, or chide my palsy, or my gout, my five gray hairs, or ruined fortune, flout. With wealth, your state, your mind, with arts improved, take you a course, get you a place, observe his honor or his grace, and the king's real or his stamped face, contemplate what you will approve, so you will let me love. Alas, alas, who's injured by my love? What merchant ships have my sighs drowned? Who says my tears have overflowed his ground? When did my colds a forward spring remove? When did the heats which my veins fill add one man to the plaguey bill? Soldiers find wars, and lawyers find out still litigious men with quarrels move, though she and I do love. Call us what you will, we're made such by love. Call her one, me another fly. We're tapers too, and at our own cost die, and we in us, the eagle and the dove. The phoenix riddle hath more wit by us. We two, being one, are it. So to one neutral thing both sexes fit, we die and rise the same and prove mysterious by this love. We can die by it, if not live by love. And if unfit for tomb or hearse our legend be, it will be fit for verse. And if no piece of chronicle we prove, we'll build in sonnets pretty rooms, as well a well-wrought urn becomes the greatest ashes as half-acre tombs. And by those hymns all shall approve us canonized for love, and thus invoke us. You whom reverend love made one another's hermitage, you to whom love was peace that is now rage, who did the whole world's soul extract and drove into the glasses of your eyes, so made such mirrors and such spies that they did all to you epitomize, countries, towns, courts. Beg from above a pattern of your love."
Again, the big picture,
yes.
Little picture, and we in our love, our sonnets in pretty rooms set the pattern for the big picture.
That's right. And in the end, one thing that Dunn sometimes does, he gets so far into a simile or a metaphor that, you know, reading aloud, even after years of reading it, you forget where you are, which verb is going with which noun. And that's part of the play of it. You know, I was thinking about this and sometimes tell students, my father's from Alabama. So we had a little bit of a family feud a couple weeks ago with Alabama-Wisconsin game. And, you know, one way to have fixed the problem would have been if all the players had, instead of running against each other, if they had all gotten on the same side and run together, they could have scored more touchdowns instead of trying to tackle each other. Right?
Uh-huh.
That wouldn't be football. That wouldn't be the game. And I think sometimes saying, yes, the poetry, it's confusing and it's doing something. That's the game. You don't want to see you don't want it to be simple. You want it to be complex. To play.
It's a puzzle in a way.
It's a puzzle.
Yeah.
And you want the contradictions. You want to have to work for it. And it's you know, we do that with other things we do, watching football. We want there to be a struggle. And poetry creates the struggle that's, I think, eventually sort of produces a sense of joy in figuring it out or figuring out where the verb goes with which noun.
But at the same time, in contrast to a lot of Shakespeare, this language is very modern.
Yes.
There's very little. I mean, the Seven Sleepers Den, you might have to, you know, look that up. But otherwise, you don't have to look up most of these words.
I think that's right. And I think that, you know, even where you see these, you know, you have this sense, the eagle and the dove and the phoenix riddle, that there's something there you might be able to dig into and learn more about. Mm-hmm. It doesn't stop you from understanding what he's saying. And I, for my money, it's this second to last stanza where he talks about our legend will be fit for verse, and if no piece of chronicle we prove, we'll build in sonnet pretty rooms. And this is part of that idea of immortalizing one's love in poetry and in written sonnets. You know, what's interesting is John Donne wrote the epitaph for his wife's tomb, Anne's tomb. Or there was a chancel in a church, and that was carved and engraved in stone. which is a stronger material than paper. It does not survive in stone. It was ruined, and we only know that epitaph from paper, from having a record of that. So there was this idea that you could, in this period, Donne was aware of how much reduplication of his poems are happening. He could immortalize. He could write this, and then there would be perhaps within a few years 50 other versions that'd be circulating in other people's books, and he could memorialize
50 little rooms.
Yeah. At the same time, we were going to talk about the Triple Fool in that 1633 edition that I was looking at just recently. That is the next poem, and it's a poem that is aware of perhaps how foolish it is to try to write one's love in poetry. So it comes right here. It's an interesting conjunction, right? It comes right on the heels of this idea that we're going to live in sonnets.
Yeah, that's another thing that that I think Elizabethans wrestled with is, you know, how can I capture what I'm trying to say in a poem? Of course, I mean, it's runs, right, the aforementioned Coleridge, as a matter of fact, even wrestles with the same thing in a poem like Kubla Khan. How can I do it?
You know,
how can I accomplish it? But the Triple Fool, that's a catchy title right there.
It is. And you have to, you immediately say, what's happening here? And I'm going to perhaps find this, unless you want to read it.
I could read it.
Yeah,
try my hand at John Donne. I am two fools, I know, for loving and for saying so in whining poetry. But where's that wise man that I would not be, I, if she would not deny? Then as the earth's inward narrow crooked lanes do purge sea water's fretful salt away, I thought if I could draw my pains through rhyme's vexation, I should them allay. Grief brought to numbers cannot be so fierce, for he tames it that fetters it in verse. But when I have done so, some man, his art and voice to show, doth set and sing my pain, and by delighting many frees again grief which verse did restrain. To love and grief tribute of verse belongs, but not of such as pleases when 'tis read. Both are increased by such songs, for both their triumphs so are published, and I, which was two fools, do so grow three, who are a little wise the best fools be. Who are a little wise the best fools be.
Yeah, it's a... And you see, he's bringing these proverbs like this little wise best fools be. But what I love here, he says, okay, maybe we can parse it. We've got fool number one is in love, right? This is the first problem.
Mm-hmm.
Fool number two is going to complicate it by writing. If you've ever been approached by a friend who's in love and wants you to read his poem,
not always the best stuff.
Yeah, because you're working through it. But I'm working through this vexation. His grief brought to numbers cannot be so fierce, for he tames it that fetters it in verse. But sometimes that tamed emotion does not always read that well. And so he imagines, okay, now I'm a double fool. But when I've done it, and there you get that pun that he will
done
use
it.
Over and over,
yes.
When I have done so. Somebody comes along and maybe with a lute sets it to music and starts singing it. And he talks here, there's this idea that it is being, in fact, published, even though, not printed perhaps, but published as being, it's being made public. So this was a private idea, and this is for the private and the public done is also an interesting one.
Yes.
This is a private situation where he's writing about his love. Somebody comes along, but somehow, how did it get from private to public? He perhaps shared it with somebody, right? So this is done always leaking, like, oh, I wouldn't want you to talk about the mischievous of my youth, but I'm also not doing anything to stop you from copying this poem about the flea that I'm setting right there for you.
Yeah, he has an interesting twofold way of thinking about this dissemination, because in another poem, love poem, he says, 'twere profanation of our joys to tell the laity of our love. And I always think about that line whenever I hear somebody like in a public place, the last thing they say on the phone is, well, I love you. You know, it's like profanation of your joys there, you know, to just tell everybody.
Yeah.
We're going to look at one of Donne's most powerful poems and also at some of his prose when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Joshua Calhoun, who's exploring with us the writings of John Donne, powerful Elizabethan writer who had two components to his personality and often mixed them. There was the wild Jack Donne, the womanizer, the early figure, and then later the religious figure. He was a cleric, an Anglican cleric later in life, and wrote poems in a religious vein, too, and as I say, sometimes combined the early Jack Donne with the later John Donne. And he does that in, for example, A Hymn to God the Father, one of the most powerful poems about doubt I think you'll ever find.
Yeah. We have somebody who's converted and yet it still seems to have an act of faith. One way to, I think, trivialize that conversion is to say, oh, he's playing a political game. Another way is perhaps to see him, and I think we'll see this in the meditation, thinking about a Catholic church as a universal church, as a place where the community, the body can come together and share a faith. And he seems to be working that out through his life. And so as much as he's setting Jack Donne out there as a character that used to be, he's got a lot of sin to be thinking about.
Well, there is that.
You know, what exactly is happening to this sin, and how does it go away? And I think that this poem speaks to that doubt. And how much sin can you do before you've done too much?
Tip the balance.
With the pun on done.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah, he writes, "Wilt thou forgive that sin where I begun, which is my sin, though it were done before? Wilt thou forgive those sins through which I run and do them still, though still I do deplore? When thou hast done, thou hast not done, for I have more. Wilt thou forgive that sin by which I've won others to sin and made my sin their door? Wilt thou forgive that sin which I did shun a year or two, but wallowed in a score? When thou hast not done, for I have more. I have a sin of fear that when I've spun my last thread, I shall perish on the shore. Swear by thyself that at my death this sun shall shine as it shines now and heretofore. And having done that, thou hast done. I have no more."
That's blasphemous.
It is. And you know, part of the blasphemy is I think there's a cuteness to it. And this is sometimes where Donne can be really attractive and sometimes a little bit precocious. He's not only punning on his own name, he's punning on his wife's name, more, her maiden name. So thou hast not done, for I have more. And sometimes you'll see it in the manuscript versions, thou hast not, small d, done. And when thou hast done, small d, thou hast not, capital D, two N's, done.
Which I'm sure is what he intended.
Yeah. So, you know, when you've done that, you still don't have me. I'm not fully brought all the way around. And there is a I think there's a willingness to play with blasphemy.
Yeah, well, apparently, yeah.
I don't think it's absolutely atypical of the period. I think they realize that, but it's part of an active relationship, I think. I think it's evidence of it.
It's certainly a poem written by a person who feels that he has no intermediaries between him and God.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. This is a Protestant. So this is a moment where you see, he does not need a priest in between. He is talking directly to God, and this I think is you mentioned earlier. There's a sense of modernity to his poems. There's a sense that they don't always feel like they're from the 17th century, late 6th, you know, but they, I think part of it is he is very loose with his rhyme schemes. He doesn't he's kind of okay if they match visually. And that allows him a little bit more freedom, and it feels a bit more like what we'd see in Walt Whitman later.
Sure.
But I think also something that's pretty modern about what he feels modern to us is this, just, I'm going to have a talk with God.
Yes.
And it's this, it's the power of lyric poetry. We're so used to lyrics. We talk about lyrics of songs, and we're so, but that lyric, it technically it's the I'm speaking. And so often it's, I'm speaking to my love. I'm trying to, as Jack Dunn, he's often speaking to somebody he's trying to get in bed. But now he's speaking directly to God. And he has the same frankness with God that he has with the woman he's trying to get into bed. And it's astounding.
It's an equality when he says, swear by thyself. In other words, swear in God's name, God,
yeah, that's right.
Not die. And then I'll believe you. Then I'll believe it.
Yeah. And, you know, there's something interesting here. I was thinking about, again, I'm going to go back to, I love spending time and looking at the different publications of in 1633, that first printing. There was an interesting thing that I noticed when I was looking at this poem in it yesterday. And it's in that line towards the end, he says, that where he just says, swear by thyself that at my death this sun shall shine as it shines now and heretofore. Now, the sun is sometimes spelled S-U-N.
Right.
Sun. Sometimes it's the sun, God. In that version, it's clearly Jesus, the sun, shall shine as it shines now. But interestingly, shines now in that printed edition, 1633, the printer doesn't put a space between those two words. And it pulls out a pun that may, you know, with Dunn, I'll never put past him that a pun wasn't intended. I think he fit as much in as he could, and this is a perfect example. But here's what you get if you have shines now, and you're reading it along, you know it, but when I was reading it along yesterday, I broke it at shine snow. it made me wonder, is Dunn pulling out also this, though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow.
Oh, sure.
And at just a moment, I'd never seen that before until it was put together. Maybe it was just a printer's error that was absolutely unintended, but there it is.
And but as you say, Josh, I mean, he is the poet who was aware of the printed word. And that's why, I mean, for example, the sun pun, which I guess is fairly popular among Elizabethan's works, much better in print than it does orally. And also, I would guess that the sort of loose rhyme scheme works better in print than it would in an oral tradition.
It does. I think it works well, though, that loose rhyme scheme does work well in hymns, in singing. And what's interesting about this, we've talked about how this particular poem seems sacrilegious. This is one of the ones that was set to music and sung
really
in St. Paul's Cathedral during Dunn's lifetime.
Wow.
And so, yeah, if you can imagine this being sung before the congregation, that I think that's astounding.
There's a poem that I would almost include as a companion poem to this one when it comes to Dunn and doubt, religious doubt, and that is Batter My Heart, which is about as wrenched as it can be in terms of taking two things that are very far apart and putting them together in the very last line of the poem.
Yeah, he wants to, well, perhaps we should just read it rather than explain it. It sort of explains itself. He says, batter my heart, three-personed God, for you as yet but knock, breathe, shine, and seek to mend that I may rise and stand. Or throw me and bend your force to break, blow, burn, and make me new. I, like an usurped town, to another do labor to admit you, but all to no end. Reason, your viceroy in me should defend, but is captived, and proves weak or untrue. Yet dearly I love you, and would be loved fain, but am betrothed unto your enemy. Divorce me, untie or break that knot again. Take me to you, imprison me, for I, except you enthrall me, never shall be free, nor ever chaste, except you ravish me.
it doesn't get much more vivid, much more potent than that.
No,
that,
and
that metaphor.
It doesn't, and you can see he's even doing this. I think this is a wonderful example to look at of how he uses the sounds of the words, not just the rhyme, but the sounds within the words. And so you have, you know, he's talking about, I need you to do more. You're breathing and you're shining and you're seeking to mend. And if you hear those sounds, you get these the th sound, which is sort of an aspirate th and a shine. And we talk about that m sound as a liquid. A really easy way to think is can this sound, can this letter sound be sounded on its own? So the n, you can say it's n, but b or t. But you have to keep repeating. So
yes.
there's these hard syllables, and what they do is they're called mutes. They shut it down. They stop the breath. And you can see here with breathe, shine, seek to mend. So we're carrying those words out. They take a longer space. But then what he wants God to do is break, blow, burn, and make me new. So that break and make, and there's that internal rhyme as well. And I can just imagine Dunn just playing with these words forever. And then what's great about it is in these various manuscripts, you see other people playing with them and slightly changing them, and we're not ever quite sure.
Slightly different
That's right.
Medium. Before we go on to the famous Meditation 17 of John Donne, I wanted to mention that website.
Oh, yes. So one way I think to enjoy some of these variations, there's a terrific website called Digital Donne. It's got digitized editions of the 1633, the first printing, the 1635, and these are good. There are some digitizations of books that are hard to work with. These are very good, but what's also wonderful is you can look at manuscripts. Some of them are a little harder to read. Some of them are in a italic hand that you'll be able to read with a little work, which I think is fun. And you can compare, say, the flea in one of the manuscript versions with that 1633 version.
The Meditation 17 we mentioned at the beginning, for whom the bell tolls, mm-hmm. No man is an island. Those phrases both come from this rather short meditation of John Donne's.
Yeah, we see throughout he's picked up on Pauline theology, that is the theology of the Apostle Paul, even in that last poem or the last couple poems we read, that you know, the good that I would do, I don't do, I keep sinning. And here he picks up on the famous image of the body. It's in, you know, Paul talks about we're all members of one body. Shakespeare picks up on this at the beginning of Julius Caesar as a metaphor. Marcus Aurelius, who Donne would have known, was also picking up on this idea that we're all part of the same community, the same body. And I think here we see a really charged argument for a church that that can handle having some people with Catholic leanings and some people with Protestant leanings. And here he says the church is Catholic, universal. He's immediately defined. So the word Catholic actually, you know, means in its etymology universal. The church is universal. So are all her actions. All that she does belongs to all. When she baptizes a child, that action concerns me, for that child is thereby connected to that head, which is my head too, and engrafted into that body whereof I am a member. And what strikes me about this, when we hear Hemingway say, you know, for whom the bell tolls, we tend to think, maybe I should just, again, my father from Alabama said, you got a frog in your pocket? I tend to think, or I have thought, you know, it's about somebody not realizing that they're going to die. But that's not what Donne is saying here. He's saying we're all part of the same body.
Right.
When the bell tolls for someone, it tolls for all.
Each man's death diminishes me.
That's right.
Therefore, sin not to ask for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee.
That's right. Community, we see, is so important to Donne in his later life. He's the dean of St. Paul's, and he is trying to bring about a sort of peace, a reconciliation, I think, for himself and for his congregation and for his nation. And his nation, unfortunately, is headed headlong towards civil war.
Joshua Calhoun, it's been a great pleasure exploring the works of John Donne.
Thank you. I've enjoyed this so much.
Hope you can join us again. And I hope you can join me again for University of the Air.